The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the second case of the day, the NLRB versus Niblock Excavating. Mr. Moritz.
Good morning. This matter is before the court on the National Labor Relations Board's application for enforcement of and the company's petition for review of the board's final order in case 25CA26323 et al. The case involves contested portions of the board's order concerning company hiring policies, refusal to hire findings, employee Michael Kramer's wages and work assignments, drug testing, and the drug testing related discharge of employee Kevin Weicker. The board committed procedural and substantive errors in invalidating various company hiring policies, most notably the 30-day application retention policy. The union alleged an unlawful change in hiring policies as early as November of 1998. The policy allegation was dismissed by Region 25 of the board, and on May 10, 1999, the region issued a complaint on two residual charges involving purportedly unlawful statements of supervisors and the layoff of a single employee. On July 20, 1999, the board's Office of Appeals issued a letter rejecting the union's final challenge to the region's determination concerning the purported change in company hiring policies. At that point, the change in hiring policies allegation was a dead issue. Nevertheless, the board invalidates the company's policies based on this dismissed allegation. Significantly, the board wholly fails to explain how or why it reached the policy change issue in this case. In an attempt to backfill the board's decision, the board's brief and the union's brief offer practically six different potential explanations. For instance, the change issue is closely related to the May 1999 complaint. The issue was fully and fairly litigated. The policies, while facially neutral, have a desperate or discriminatory impact on union applicants. The policies themselves are inherently destructive of an important employee right. A continuing violation theory and facial invalidity. The problem with all of these potential theories is that the board did not advance any of them in its decision. And of course, it's only the board's rationale that counts. None of the theories further cure the board's decision. The board was not entitled to resuscitate the policy implementation claim unless it closely related to the original May 10, 1999 complaint. The board cannot, even if it had attempted.
Did you argue this question before the board?
The closely related question or the general due process issue?
The question whether this was within the scope of the charge.
Absolutely. Once the ALJ's decision came down, the brief in support of exceptions spent about 30 pages raising both the general 10B argument as well as the alternative. Even if it wasn't barred by the statute of limitations, the board's advanced no theory that resuscitates the dead charge. Now, even if the general counsel had revised, the issue, the fact is that he didn't. The general counsel never sought an amendment. He never took any other steps alerting the company that it is pursuing the dismissed claim. Obviously, the company had known at trial, prior to trial, the policy change theory was at issue. The company would have responded with a statute of limitations defense. Third, and regardless of whether the board could have properly reached the issue, the board's decision clearly violated the company's due process rights. Any lingering doubt regarding the proposition that the hiring policies were outside the complaint and were not, in fact, litigated is removed by the general counsel's own brief to the administrative law judge. The general counsel...
The federal rules of civil procedure are unconstitutional because they say that the pleadings are deemed amended to conform to the evidence at trial.
Do I think the federal rules of civil procedure are unconstitutional? No, I don't.
But that seems to be your theory here, that if the board permits the pleadings to be deemed amended to conform to the evidence at trial, that's unconstitutional. That is, of course, a perfectly ordinary step in hundreds of ongoing civil cases. I don't know why it would be unconstitutional when done by an agency and perfectly okay when done every day by a court.
But in those cases, the evidence is sufficient to give you notice during the course of the trial that the policy is at issue. Here, nothing, save General Counsel Exhibit 8, introduced on the first day of hearing, even suggests that the General Counsel is pursuing the dismissed policy claim. The General Counsel has every incentive to create the largest number of openings possible. He knows he has to, and yet in his brief, never once does he argue a policy change. Never once does he apply a six-month as opposed to 30-day retention period. Instead, he goes consistently. Every time he discusses an alleged refusal to hire, he applies the 30-day period. Also, the board musters absolutely no evidence establishing or even suggesting that the company ever applied a longer period than 30 days to application. There's not a single example of an application retained for a longer period. And in fact, a six-month period, as the union's brief happily recognizes, makes no sense in the construction industry where the season is over in that time period. Turning to the SALT and the bona fide nature of their application in an effort to secure work, the board's brief contends that the company is asking the court to, quote, add a requirement to its refusal to hire analysis. The requirement the board feels does not need to be added is one that, again quoting from the board's brief, applicants must demonstrate a genuine interest in working. Contrary to the board's view, the term applicant presupposes that the job seeker act in a manner which demonstrates an interest in work. Inherent in one's status as an applicant is that you want a job, and you're going to behave like you want a job. Here, the SALT's own actions gave the company a reasonable basis to conclude that they were not, in fact, interested in work. The 7 June 2000 SALT, and that is all of the refused to hire claims excluding Michael Young and Brandon Taylor, never acted like an applicant, or a normal applicant, not one time. From the very beginning, the SALT engaged in behavior that no other bona fide job seeker would exhibit. They turned video cameras on company receptionists, submitted mass applications, and placed the entire production in terms of ongoing litigation, not work. A true applicant does not provide a courtesy copy of their application to the board's Office of Appeals in Washington, D.C. A true applicant does not seek a job by arguing with the employer's facially neutral policies. Instead, the term applicant, as it's generally used, describes a person who, unlike the SALTs in this case, goes out of his or her way to impress, not argue with, the employer. SALTs are not bona fide applicants, and more importantly, they didn't act like bona fide applicants. The board's findings regarding Michael Young are similarly unreasonable. At this point, it's worth pointing out that there's only two sort of straight men in this entire drama. Michael Young, who immediately was scheduled for a second interview, and union member Glenn Brickley, who was actually hired. And they engaged in none of the conduct or misconduct engaged in by the June 2000 SALTs. It is undisputed that upon Young's initial interview, area manager Ron Moglin, the same person the board determined discriminated against him, immediately scheduled Young for a second interview. If Moglin harbored anti-union animus, there's simply no reason for Moglin to jump through this hoop. According to Young's own testimony, he met with Moglin, and Moglin, quote, first and foremost, was interested in the number of operating hours listed on Young's application. As Young admits, the number of hours listed on his application are extremely high. Young calls it thousands upon thousands of hours of operating experience. Moglin contacted Young's former employer and asked about the number of hours listed, and Moglin's contact questioned whether Young actually had worked that many hours on the equipment. On that basis, Moglin declined to hire Young and then turned around and hired another union member, Brickley. Moglin's actions are simply not those of someone acting based on anti-union animus, and therefore the board's findings regarding Young can't be enforced. The board also erred in mandating a wage increase in winter work to employee Michael Kramer. Without question, the raise allegedly promised to Kramer was to have occurred on August 17, 1999. as of that date, and as Kramer admits, he had not engaged in any union activity. Absent such a showing, the board's order cannot stand. Second, the winter work finding is based on nothing more than an identical instant replay of Moglen and Kramer's interactions in 1997. In 97, Kramer contends, Moglen said that he would try his best to get him winter work. He didn't, and Kramer concluded he lied to him. When Kramer came back, and the testimony of these two gentlemen, by the way, is almost verbatim identical, had the same conversation about the possibility of winter work, and come winter, Moglen again laid him off as he had in 97, along with almost everyone else in the Columbia City facility. The board's decision rests exclusively on comments made by Richard Bunn. Bunn, however, placed absolutely no part in how or how much Kramer is paid, or whether Kramer works during the winter. The board's brief contends that because Bunn is an agent with apparent authority, respondent may be held responsible for his acts. This may be true, but the acts respondent is, the company is responsible for, are Bunn's supposedly unlawful statements. Bunn's status as an agent with apparent authority does not mean that Bunn becomes the decision maker in regards to Kramer's wages and winter work. That role, indisputably, rests with Moglen. And again, Moglen treated Kramer exactly the same both before and after his over-union activity. The board's findings regarding Kramer are absurd and should not be enforced. The board's findings regarding Brandon Taylor also lack merit. David Taylor, who is Brandon Taylor's father, adhered to a practice of personally referring potential job seekers for hire. David Taylor abandoned this practice in regards to his son and never asked anyone at the company to consider his son for hire. Further, the company previously turned down David Taylor's referral of his father for employment well prior to any of the union activity at the company's Bristol facility, a fact wholly ignored by the board. The board also erred in rejecting the company's stated reason for not hiring Brandon Taylor, known drug arrests involving the Taylor household. There is simply no basis for the conclusion that the company, a small-town employer operating out of Bristol, Indiana, did not actually consider Brandon Taylor's residence in the house that was the subject of a known drug arrest. Finally, the board produces insufficient, in fact, no evidence in support of its claims regarding Weikert's drug test. First, there's absolutely no evidence, or whether direct or indirect, that estimator Kevin Crouch, who works approximately an hour away out of the Bristol facility, acted based on anti-union animus. Second, there's no evidence that Crouch knew that Weikert, who again works nearly an hour away, was engaged in strike activity or even supported the union. Crouch is an estimator working out of the Bristol office. He's not at ground zero working with Weikert or anyone else. And importantly, the testimony of the union's own witnesses tends to establish that Weikert's refusal to take his drug test has nothing to do with union issues or union support generally. Storm, one of Weikert's fellow strikers, admits that Weikert never attributed his drug selection to union activity. Storm and Michael Kramer both told Weikert prior to his discharge, hey, if I were you, I would take the test. And so Weikert refused. After refusing for more than a day and a half, finally on Saturday, the company discharged Weikert. Over the weekend, Weikert called union organizer Philip Overmeyer, who, like Storm and Kramer, said, Kevin, if I were you, I would take the test. But by that point, of course, it's too late. And Weikert never attempted to contact or did not get in contact with the company until Tuesday, some 3 days after his discharge. The board's findings regarding Weikert may not be enforced. No questions?
Pardon?
No questions?
Not yet.
Now, just turning back to the due process argument and the hiring policy argument that we raised, now I'd point out that, you know, at times the board is allowed to revive dead charges through amendment, but there's no amendment here. And the Office of Appeals has ruled, and I direct your attention at the end of the general counsel's case in chief, where the general counsel rests subject to a decision by the Office of Appeals regarding one issue, I'm not sure what, but the Office of Appeals is still considering. clearly the general counsel understood that when the Office of Appeals issues a directive, it means something. And this is the same reason that the Office of Appeals had upheld in regards to the change in hiring policy allegations. Also, you know, the judge in throughout this decision places all the critical findings in footnotes, particularly the one which notes the company has not raised a statute of limitations argument, but in any event, he concludes that such an argument wouldn't work. Well, the company can't be faulted for failing to raise an argument where neither the pleadings nor the progress of the hearing even indicate that the board is attempting to resuscitate a charge that's been dead for over a year and a half. And again, it's no coincidence the general counsel, you know, through 100 and some pages of brief, never once makes that argument. Thank you.
Ms. Dinan?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Warsha Dinan. I represent the board which seeks enforcement of its order. In this case, the company was bound and determined to avoid organizing by the union. And in order to stop it, the company unlawfully threatened and coerced employees, including resorting to violence, assisted a rival union, discriminated against employees, including discharge, layoff, denial of a raise, and demotion. They also refused to hire non-union applicants based on new hiring policies designed to exclude them. I'd first like to turn to the issue of these new hiring policies and address some of the procedural issues that the company has raised. The company created four new hiring policies in response to the union's organizing campaign. First, they began to refuse accepting applications altogether. Second, they began to require that applicants have no experience whatsoever, essentially excluding all organizers who no doubt have experience in the industry. Third, they began to require referrals, in a sense, recommendations from current employees. Now, it's true that in the past, they had used a referral as a factor in their decision, but they had never previously used that as a reason to reject an applicant. And fourth, they began to retain applications for only 30 days instead of 6 months. With respect to
what evidence is there that they had a policy, as a means of retaining applications more than 30 days? What does the record show on that?
All right. If I can just ask the court's indulgence, I need to get into the nitty-gritty of the evidence here.
Okay.
There's two documents at issue here. The first is General Counsel's Exhibit 8, and that's the one that's being questioned by the company. That document states a retention policy of 6 months. The company is now claiming, although it did not do so at the hearing, that that document is not a company document. I point out that General Counsel's Exhibit 31
was identified as a company document at the hearing?
Yes, it was introduced as a company document.
That's not what I asked. Was it identified as a company document?
Well, the way it was presented at hearing was the company's owner was asked, do you recognize this document? Is it a company document? And he stated that it looked like a company document. And there was no objection to its admission based on authenticity. If you look at General Counsel's Exhibit 31, which is undisputedly a company document, it's the exact same document as General Counsel's Exhibit 8, down to a typographical error in paragraph number 4. And furthermore, when Michael Young applied for the second time in January 1999, he referenced his previous application from 1998. And in that context, the company's receptionist stated that the company was only keeping applications for 30 days now. And the company never called that receptionist to rebut Mr. Young's testimony. And again, Mr. Nyblock never denied that the company had a six-month policy. If I could turn to the procedural issues,
Didn't he also testify he didn't recall keeping applications for 6 months?
Yes, he stated that he couldn't recall a policy of 6 months, although he never specifically denied having a 6 month policy. And I submit that the documentary evidence certainly fills in any ambiguities in Mr. Niblock's testimony.
That documentary evidence being this
General Counsel's Counsel. Exhibit 8, particularly in comparison with General Counsel's Exhibit 31.
Yeah, that was introduced in what context, though?
Well, the company raises this in their reply brief for the first time. The company claims that around page 26 of the transcript that there was a discussion of an employer response to salting campaigns known as Comet. However, General Counsel's Exhibit 8 was not actually introduced into evidence until 20 pages later, around pages 45 to 46. That was not in the context of this Comet program. It was in the context of the company's policies. With respect to the due process issue, the board found here that the company had notice of the issue of the hiring policies from the complaint, as well as the evidence at the hearing. Paragraph 7B in the complaint raises the issue of hiring policies. It states that the company discriminatorily enforced its hiring procedures by refusing to hire or consider union applicants. Furthermore, the company raised their hiring policies as a defense to the refusals to hire at the hearing. So clearly the issue of the hiring policies was well known to all parties. In our brief, we also raise an alternative argument that should the court find that the company did not have notice from the complaint and the hearing, that the board is allowed to find unalleged violations where the facts are closely related to timely allegations and fully litigated. In this case, the hiring policy issue is closely related to allegations.
Do you agree that this question was raised before the board?
Well, if you look at the company's brief to the board, which is in the company's appendix submitted to the court, it's not particularly clear, but at the same time, we cannot argue that the company waived the issue.
Not sure what your answer is.
Well, my answer is we're not making
in
an argument.
In the board's view, was this issue raised or not?
In the board's view, it was sufficiently raised to preclude waiver.
Uh-huh. But the board didn't discuss it.
Well, the board did not discuss the closely related analysis that we have raised as an alternative argument in our brief. The board
How can we rely on an argument in your brief when it was not an argument made by the agency?
Well, we're raising...
Because we're supposed to rely on the agency's rationale, and it, apparently, with respect to this issue anyway, the agency has no stated rationale whatsoever.
Sure, the board does have a stated rationale. I guess I didn't make that clear. The board's rationale is that the company had notice of the hiring policy issue from the complaint and hearing. However, we raised the issue of the closely related, fully litigated analysis as an alternative argument should the court rule against the board's decision in terms of the notice issue. And it was in that context that we raised the issue. I'd also like to point out, getting back to the closely related argument, the hiring policies were closely related to allegations that in May and June of 1998, the company told employees that it was not hiring because some applicants were engaged in union activity. All of these issues are part of the company's early efforts to exclude union applicants. And as I mentioned previously, the issue was fully litigated. And just getting to the issue of whether an amended complaint is required, it is not required. It's clear that the board may find unalleged violations as long as they're closely related and fully litigated. If you look at the cases that the company cites, particularly Red Eye, in those cases, the general counsel did amend the complaint there, or at least move to amend the complaint, but they do not state a requirement that the general counsel do so. And I'd also like to note, even assuming that the court accepts the company's arguments regarding the procedural issues. The application of those policies are still unlawful, and we cite a couple cases, Giddings and Lewis and Shoemate, with respect to that. And I'd also like to note the significance or the impact of this issue of the 30-day rule. The 30-day rule with respect to the refusals to hire does not affect the merits of the violation. It only affects the remedy. And I'd just like to run through a couple points with respect to the refusals to hire. With respect to whether they're bona fide applicants or not, the company has offered no evidence that these employees wouldn't have worked. All of them said that they would work and that they would accept any position.
Can there be some inference drawn from where they live?
The company certainly hasn't raised any kind of location argument. There was no question that they would be able to report to work.
It was in their brief. They're 4 hours away from where the location was, their home.
Well, certainly, but there's no indication that they wouldn't have been able to report to work. And in terms of sort of casting these people as, you know, not real-world applicants, you have to understand that this was no longer a real-world situation. When you have company policies that they no longer accepted applications, they wouldn't keep the applications longer than 30 days, but at the same time wouldn't allow the applicants to renew their applications. This is not a real-world situation by any means. And the fact that the applicants were persistent in pursuing employment with the company does not render their activity unprotected. And with respect to Michael Young and Randy Patton, I just point out quickly that the company's explanations for why they weren't hired were discredited, and as the court said in Beverly, California case, credibility arguments are just never worth making. And finally, I'd just like to touch on Mr. Kramer and Mr. Weichert. With respect to Mr. Kramer, the fact that Mr. Bunn was not the company agent responsible for making decisions is completely irrelevant. The company is still liable for his admissions regarding the company's motive for its actions against Mr. Kramer. And finally, with respect to Mr. Weichert, the timing here is striking. The drug test was ordered a few hours after he returned from strike. All three of the strikers at that facility were retaliated against. And it was Mr. Modlin and Mr. Bunn who pulled them aside for the test, not Mr. Crouch. And therefore, if they were not behind the test, they certainly condoned it. We're not using Mr. Crouch to impute knowledge to the company. That's undisputed. Unless there's any other questions,
thank you, Ms. Dean. Ms. Kuliak?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Alexia Kulwick, and I represent the intervener in this case, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150. The campaign at issue before you began in 1998, when employees began demonstrating great support for Local 150, such as attending union meetings and signing union authorization cards. As referred to briefly by counsel for the board, there are uncontested findings that are relevant to the animus, which are, of course, relevant to the other charges that are before the board. And briefly, those uncontested findings include findings that early in the campaign in 1998, Niblock Excavating went to a rival labor organization to try to sign its employees up with them to avoid Local 150's organizing efforts. That rival organization was called the Christian Labor Association. The uncontested findings also demonstrate that Niblock interrogated and threatened its employees. It instructed an employee not to support the union or to talk about the union, and it physically assaulted an employee because of his support for Local 150. These uncontested findings are relevant to the charges that are still before this court today. The record demonstrates substantial evidence, Your Honor, supporting the board's other findings that Niblock refused to hire applicants because of their union affiliation and support, that Niblock Excavating discriminated against an employee by laying him off because of his support, and then when bringing that employee back, demoted him because of his support for Local 150. Substantial evidence also supports the board's finding that Niblack discharged an employee because of his support for Local 150. I'd like to address three aspects of this case before the court today. One, the board properly found discrimination against union supporters, both employees and applicants. Two, the board properly ordered back pay and instatement to all of the union discriminatees. And three, the board properly rescinded Niblack's hiring policies. Before I get into that argument, Your Honors, I would like to point out, in response to one of your questions on procedural issues, that in both footnotes 14 of the board's decision and footnote 41 of the board's decision, the board does, in fact, address procedural concerns. In footnote 14, the board says that paragraph 7B of the board's complaint adequately put Niblack on notice that its hiring policies were at issue in this case. The board likewise finds...
I'm looking at the board's decision. It doesn't have any footnote 17 or any footnote 41.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. On page 8 of the board...
You're referring to the administrative law judge's decision?
Right. That's incorporated in the board's decision. Sorry, Your Honor.
No. If somebody says the ALJ made an error and you ask for the board's view on that and the three-judge board is silent, all we got is the ALJ's decision. That's part of the problem.
I understand, Your Honor. And in the part of the decision actually written by the board, they don't necessarily address this issue. However, the fact that the ALJ did even on its own consider the issue and decide that there would not be any due process concerns or 10B concerns demonstrated that the ALJ thought about the issue and ruled on it. And then the board, in affirming that decision, affirmed the ALJ's decision in this case. Your Honor, there's substantial evidence to support the finding that Niblack discriminated against union supporters, both employees and union applicants. As the brief demonstrate, SES requires that to prove a refusal to hire a case, the general counsel show that Niblack was hiring at the time, that the applicants had the requisite experience and training, and that the company had animus against the union that went to its decision not to hire these individuals. All three of those requirements were met in this case. At each time the applicants applied, Your Honor, there were job openings for each of them. In January of 1999, when Mr. Young applied, the company had been soliciting another employee, Steve Storm, that demonstrates that available position. When applicants Mr. Payton and Mr. Taylor applied, within 1 month of their applications, five new employees were hired. Again, there were positions available. And within 3 months of the six remaining union applicants, eight employees were hired. Therefore, each of these applicants had a position. Each of the applicants in the record demonstrates they had the sufficient experience and training, and as the uncontested findings show, the company had animus against Local 150. Accordingly, there were positions for each of these individuals, so under FES and this court's decision in StarCon, instatement and back pay to each of those individuals was appropriate. There's also substantial evidence, Your Honor, to demonstrate that the company discriminated against employees working for Niblack Excavating. First, Your Honor, Michael Kramer, there was substantial evidence that demonstrated that he, in fact, vocalized his support for Local 150 and that he had been promised that he would work through the winter work. Yet in December of 1999, he was laid off, and when he returned in April, he was demoted to a laborer's position. Niblack's counsel is attacking the credibility of the different witnesses' testimony before the administrative law judge. The judge considered the testimony of both sides and made a credibility determination that he, in fact, believes the testimony of Mr. Kramer. Likewise, with Mr. Weikart and Mr. Rick Storm, the ALJ considered the testimony of both sides and determined that because the drug test administered was within 1/2 hour after these individuals returned to work following a 2-day strike, that the drug test had been administered because of their union support for Local 150 and their actions of protected activity. Your Honor, there was substantial evidence demonstrating both that the applicants had positions and that the company discriminated against them. There was substantial evidence to demonstrate that the company discriminated against employees who supported Local 150. Turning quickly to the hiring policies at issue before this court,
New Black admits on page 34 of its brief, and board law demonstrates that rescission of hiring policies is an appropriate remedy even when a hiring policy is facially neutral. And what I mean by that is that the board found, and New Black does not challenge, that in addition to the unlawful implementation, the policies were discriminatorily enforced. New Black admits, and board law states, that rescission is an appropriate remedy for discriminatorily enforced hiring policies. The board found these policies to be discriminatorily enforced, and in its statement of issues before this court, New Black does not challenge that finding. For this reason, the board could have properly rescinded New Black's hiring policies, which it in fact did. And Your Honors, quickly, New Black relies upon this policy as a defense to try to limit its liability when it comes to the union applicants. I see that my time is up. Look, 150 respectfully requests that you enforce the board's order. Thank you.
Ms. Moritz?
Well, here again, I mean, I think we rolled out approximately 5 alternative theories, which in defense of the board's order, but none of them are the board's. Now, first, you know, on the due process claim, the board's attorney claims that, well, the rationale is that it relates back to the May 1999 complaint because it's closely related, but the board never makes that argument. Alternatively, she says, well, the policies themselves may not have been implemented based on improper motivation, but their application still is unlawful, but they're facially neutral policies. If you're going to claim uneven application, you need to show, for instance, an application of a non-union individual that was held more than 30 days or up to 6 months, but there's no evidence that the company ever held an application of a longer period than that stated in their policy. And, you know, the board's decision, I mean, they want you to conclude, or asking the court to conclude, look, it's okay that the allegation that this whole sort of house of cards, you know, rests on is time barred. That's okay, ignore that. It's also okay that the allegation isn't in the complaint. There's no allegation that the policy's implementation was discriminatorily motivated, because as the board's general counsel points out, they know they can't pursue that, because that was dismissed by the Office of Appeals. They also say, well, maybe it's not in the complaint, and that's not close enough. It's also okay that we don't amend, because it's fully and fairly litigated. And ignore the fact that our brief, even though it was so fully and fairly litigated, never even mentions a 6-month policy, or even claims that there was a change of policy, despite every incentive to do so. As far as Exhibit 8, I don't know what else Richard Niblock can say. He doesn't say he doesn't recall. He says, I can never remember an application remaining on file for 8 months. They are similar, no doubt. That's the only difference. But I don't know how much clearer he denies that that is his policy.
What about the language of the document?
I'm sorry?
What about the language of the document that was... that was offered as to a company policy?
Well, I thought reading the transcript that the point for where the general counsel was going is that these policies are similar to one contained in the ABC manual, and therefore sort of guilt by association, you're close to the ABC, and that somehow makes the policies unlawful, but that again is not the theory raised by the board. Second, you know, this whole, the alternative explanation is, well, the secretary, who no one knows and who Young admits is not a supervisor and has never been shown to be an agent speaking for the company on hiring matters, says, well, they're keeping him for 30 days now. Well, even the statement 30 days now doesn't suggest or even establish or even suggest a 6-month application retention policy. You know, finally, in regards to Kramer, you know, the argument, oh, I'm sorry, first Crouch, this is another alternative theory. Well, now we're not claiming, unlike the board's decision, that Crouch acted based on anti-union animus. Now we're going to pin it on Moglen and Bond because apparently the board and the union recognize that Crouch is blameless. There's no indication that Crouch even knows what's going on in Columbia City. And again, that's not the board's rationale. The board didn't reason that Bond and Moglen fixed the test or have anything to do with the test. They conclude, with no evidence, that Crouch is acting improperly, some 50 miles away. In regards to, now turning to Kramer, that's not a credibility determination. Kramer admits that the time his raise was due, he had not engaged in union activity. He says, I was promised a raise that was due around August 17th, and the first time even he comes close, and the earliest possible date is August 31st, where he refuses to take a button. The date the judge uses is 2 weeks later, September 9th, but they can't use Kramer's subsequent activity as a hook for a decision made 2 weeks earlier to not give him a raise. Finally, you know, once again, there's no evidence that any of his policies were discriminatorily enforced, either as to the referrals, or to the retention, or to accepting applications when not in hiring mode. And on the last point, not accepting applications, the testimony of Brandon Taylor is that he walked in alone while his mom waited in the car the first time he went there. He wasn't a union member, and he had no union paraphernalia on. The company, as he says, the secretary didn't know who I was, and they told him, we're not accepting applications because we're not hiring right now, the same as they had told everyone else. Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.